From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
You're tuned to Pacifica Radio, KPFT, the Mighty 90, listener-sponsored and commercial-free since March 1st of 1970. This is Open Journal, and we thank you for joining us. Welcome aboard. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Lynn Ashby is a Houston institution, a longtime journalist, or should we say newspaper man, who spent most of his career at the Houston Post. Ashby continues to churn out weekly columns that appear in the Brazosport Facts, the Heights Base, The Leader, Spring Branches, The Courier, and other neighborhood newspapers. We are pleased to have him with us today to give us his views about what's going on today about the city, state, and nation. Welcome back, Lynn, and thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me. The Spring Branch Courier, I'm not familiar with that one. Maybe I'm appearing there and not getting paid.
I'll look into it, Lynn. Churning it out like butter for quite some time. And I know I find the leader in my yard, and I look forward to it each week. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad to find you in there. While I know for certain there are others who are chagrined and have written to the publisher and have let Jonathan McElvey know that they're not too appreciative of him actually sticking some space there for Lynn Ashby to rant.
Well, I get that.
Yeah.
There's some guy who reads me in the facts down in Fort Bend County and religiously reads me and then writes a scathing letter. And I thought, buddy, I'm glad to take out your frustrations by writing me letters rather than, you know, kicking your dog and insulting your wife and children. You get your, let off your steam by writing me these semi-literate letters. But he never misses.
Well, Lynn, we're real happy to have you back on for a visit on Open Journal. It's always a pleasure to have you on the air with us. We are together experiencing now into the fifth month of Corona time here in the middle of a hot Houston summer. So as we get started in this conversation, just checking in to see how you're doing.
Well, I'm doing fine. My wife and I rarely get out of the house. We're both slightly over 65. And, the checklist of things that you shouldn't have because you're going to catch it, well, we have them all. So we sort of cocooned here, and my wife orders ahead of time, and then we just pick up our food over at the HEB, and that's kind of sometimes hit and miss. We have 14 cabbages now. I'm not sure why. but it's good. I mean, they just open the trunk, and they put it in and wave goodbye because they have our, credit card if it hadn't been revoked yet. So that's about the only time we get out. The kids, we have some children here in Houston and grandchildren, and they delight for them, and a sister-in-law who loves to cook. So we have a lot of food. Of course, my wife is a wonderful cook, and so I'm just, I miss the sports, though. I really do miss coming in and, getting a beer and watching the Astros and bang their trash can and steal signs and things like that. And, of course, the Rockets, so I do miss the sports. Otherwise, we're in good shape.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, I have a really good recipe for coleslaw I can share with you, or more importantly, with your wife, I suppose.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I'm sure she'd like to try it, although she may have her own. But, we're eating very well and, do a little takeout, but not much. And I don't dare go into a restaurant. Have you all been inside a restaurant and eaten a meal?
I actually took one trip a couple of weeks ago for a very special occasion, which was my wife's birthday. We have had a family tradition going back about the better part of three decades that for either birthday, anniversary, or any other special occasion that we can, pick on, we would go to our favorite place to eat, which is Khyber North Indian Grill down there on Richmond off Kirby. Mm-hmm. Our friend Mickey, we've followed this guy since the late 70s when he and his wife were like the host and hostess at the old Taj Mahal. Mm-hmm. And he went off and opened a place called India's behind the Dark Horse Saloon on Richmond, and then a place called the Bombay Grill over by Lee High School. And for more than a quarter century now, he's been over here on Richmond by that now closed Papado's. And one of the things most people who've never eaten at his place know is that he loves to put up these cheeky signs on the street. Kind of put one of the one side will always say something cheeky about whatever Papado's is advertising. And he set a couple of rather noteworthy signs. I started taking pictures whenever we would go. I think I'm going to make a small chapbook of Mickey's signage. But he's kind of like an Indian Peter Sellers, very dry, very smart, very humorous. I think you'd like him a lot. And we love his food, the secret ingredient of which has always been love. And it's just good Indian food, and we've known him forever. So we called ahead, and I went there for my birthday at the beginning of Corona time. We ordered it to pick up and go, and just ran away with it. And they threw in a whole bunch of extra stuff because they've known us for so long. This time, and they said, well, we have a couple of tables, and if you'd like to come, nobody's really sitting at them. And, you know, there's, you know, one or two people will come in and eat, but most are doing this Grubhub and DoorDash kind of pick up and run kind of thing. So we sat there and just had this luxurious meal for her birthday. It was a little strange eating through a mask, but, you know, we enjoyed it. It was,
need a straw for your martini.
It was great, though we've not ventured out since, and I'm more wary today than I was a few weeks ago when we pulled that off. That's maybe a one-and-done thing, you know.
What about you, Stephanie? You've been out?
Not a lot. I try and go like swim the opposite way of the stream. So if everyone's going on this time of the day, I try and go the opposite. If there are too many people in the store, I leave and I hit it earlier or later in the day. But I have enjoyed the outdoors a lot more. So the parks and just finding some great places in the city to experience some clarity and the Arboretum and things of that nature have been a really nice experience.
Well, go early in the morning when it's cool. Right now it's 100 degrees outside.
Yeah. I've put in a herb garden in our front yard and turned it into a basil and rosemary and that was a lot of fun about a month ago. It's not a lot of fun now. It's too hot too early and it's starting to burn up.
Well, I must say that we have had it better than most, but each night at 5:30, I get my vodka and we sit down and watch the news. And as they say, the anchor always begins, "Good evening," and then proceeds to tell you why it's not.
True.
Good evening. Another death fatality record was hit by Americans today. There are bodies in the street. Hey, good night. I tell you what, watching the news, both local and national, and reading about it in the newspapers is really, you know, if you could easily become pessimistic and depressed.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you feel as you talk about the news, especially for you who really are a real journalist in the sense that you're not just reporting? Do you think that the state of news and newspaper could use some revamping, or is this the way it needs to be?
Well, it is obviously the major story of not only the year, but maybe of the decade. And when you have, what do we have now, 135,000 people just in the U.S. dead, and it seems to be getting worse. And depending on which channel you want to turn on, you can turn on Fox, and there's just a few sniffles around the countryside, that's all. Don't worry, it'll get better. As Trump said, it will be a miracle by May. It'll all be gone, be zero. And, you know, that'll up your spirits. On the other hand, you turn on NBC, CBS, them, they give you the straight, and then you can flip over to Rachel Maddow, who's practically wearing a black hood during this plague. So you can switch around, and we've started watching movies and that kind of thing. We watched 1917 the other night. My wife kept demanding more war movies. Not really, but we watched it. It was a good movie, and we've watched some movies, and there's a lot of good television on that keeps you busy. We finally subscribed to Netflix. We tried it before, and it just didn't work. They had, well, we couldn't get it, and then we got it. They had nothing we wanted, so we're going to try it again. Do y'all have Netflix?
I do not.
No. No.
Well, I barely have cable, Lynn, but yeah.
Well, we've seen a couple of things on it, but really, not really. We find enough stuff to watch. We do miss the sports, but we watch a lot of news. And I tried watching Colbert the other night because I always enjoyed him. He's speaking from his basement or his den or somewhere, and there's no music and no laughter and no audience, and the writers are the same. I'm sure the material is the same, and there's certainly a lot to work with, but it just wasn't the same. It was just kind of a real downer. I mean, he'd tell a joke and then go on to the next joke because nothing happened.
Mm-hmm. That's got to be tough when there's no audience and you've built your entire career around it working a certain way, and now it's a whole new model.
Yeah, well, when you're a professional like they are, all the late night show hosts, they're used to instant feedback and kind of tune into their audience as to what's going to work that night and what isn't, and you kind of changed in midstream, but you get no feedback now. And it'd be interesting to see if their sponsors are holding up.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because I strongly suspect they've lost their audience. Their ratings are down.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've appreciated, and I think my wife maybe more than I, the kind of down-home nature. Some of these, like Colbert, has his kids and his wife are basically his grip and sound mm-hmm. man and camera crew and the whole nine yards. Mm-hmm. Jimmy Fallon has his little daughters are writing the cue cards and you know, walking through the scenes and he's doing it from his attic, and he goes into a fire escape slide to get out of the room at the end of the show, and the kids are racing him to get to the slide. And there's something about making them into actual human beings instead of just celebrity.
With lots of makeup on and bright lights. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you an interesting thing of both late night and reporters and even the anchors, their backgrounds. They all have books, lines and lines of books, and I think some of them are wallpaper. Mm-hmm. They just look, you know, just too neat. Like nobody ever reads these books. They're just stuck up there to look good. But I've noticed we watch the PBS Evening News with Judy, what's her
Woodruff.
Name?
Woodruff,
yeah. She has Grant back there, and I don't think I'm watching a series on Grant and in bits and pieces. I'm trying to figure out who won the war. And, well, they toppled his statue, you know, in San Francisco.
Yeah.
A bunch of, I guess, Black Lives Matter or something, you don't know. But, I mean, if you're equality and all of that, you don't tear down the statue of U.S. Grant.
Mm.
Oh, and Francis Scott Key, they toppled his statue.
Mm-hmm.
Probably didn't know who he was. But anyway, I noticed the background books, and they're very, very tasteful. But now the doctors, you get Dr. Fauci or Fauci in his office. It's a mess. It's a working office. You know, he's got these books and tablets and papers piled high, and you can see that he's working. Mm-hmm. Some of them are at their home in their den, including reporters. You know, and it's just too neat. I say that's not a working office. That's a background.
Yeah.
But they're in their home.
Well, Lynn, you can't see the set that we're each in our virtual studios, and that's probably all for the best. I have banker boxes piled up on one side behind me. I tried to simulate that nice wall of books, and and they're real books.
Now, where are you all?
I am in the Heights.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're at home.
I'm at home near downtown.
Yeah.
And I try and change it up in every show. I'm someplace different just with my little mic and my laptop. So
mm-hmm.
She's in a little remote cubicle somewhere down by the Astrodome at this particular visit, and we never know where we're going to catch her. Sometimes I think we're recording in the Jeep.
Yeah, well, it was pretty rough. They've got it all kind of slicked out, and actually some of the reporters and such have returned to the studios. Mm-hmm. But the first week or two, you had glitches and blackouts and echoes, and, these are multi-billion-dollar corporations that are like NBC, and they have satellites and worldwide correspondents, and they flick the wrong switch in their basement, and the lights would go out.
They really need to have a bunch of 16-year-olds, because that's who does, this is their technique.
Funny you should mention that. I have my granddaughter come over and fix my computer every time it goes down.
Because that's the way to do it.
Well, she kind of rolls her eyes and looks at her grandfather and sighs like, oh, what a turkey. You just push this. The F-61 Blitzbang plugs right into the double socket through the purple. What? You lost me. Where's the off and on switch? That's the total extent of my ability. But anyway, back to the news. They're not having trouble now. It gets pretty redundant every night. It's kind of the same thing, but it's dreadful.
Yeah, So do you think reporters have lost their ability to create stories if they can't, if it's not sort of handed to them? Do we need to rethink reporting?
Well, these are kind of the best of times and the worst of times. If you're a field reporter, say, in television, again, you're not in your studio where you can control the situation, you know, the lights, the sound, the words. You're standing wearing a mask out in 100-degree Houston temperature in front of a hospital as the ambulances start bringing people in. That's pretty rough. You should get combat pay for that. You muffle through your mask.
We're tuned to the Open Journal program on KPFT in Houston, the Mighty 90. Thank you for joining us. We're visiting with Houston Institution journalist, writer Lynn Ashby, Man About Town. We thank you for tuning in and joining us as well, dear friends out there in Radio Land. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. So as we talk about this Houston heat and Houston in general as our mecca for conversation around any topics, do you think with the shutdown of the Post many moons ago, or have we lost that which challenged us to do more complicated reporting, or is that just the way we are?
Well, it's changed since I first came to the Houston Post. We had, among other things, at City Hall, a press room, because you had two newspapers. Back then, KTRH was, news, mobile news. And we had TV stations, and, they were all there at City Hall. Well, today, I don't think they never cover City Hall anymore. They used to because they had to, because the competition would. And, of course, all of our TV stations are not only not locally owned, but they're owned out of state. Disney out of California owns, 13, and KPRC is owned by the Washington Post, which now used bought by the Graham family. Now it's owned by Jeff Bezos, the richest man in the world. And 11 is owned by Media something. They're out of a suburb of Washington, D.C. The Chronicle is owned by Hearst, this faceless corporation in a big glass building in Manhattan. So none of them really have Houston's best at heart. We're cash cows. We make money, and the more for them, the better. And they can keep cutting costs, and they do, because they don't have, the old days of, out in the field running around spending money. So we all have absentee landlords. See, now your station is locally controlled, I would say.
Yes. Locally out of control. And
but you see, you zero in on local matters, and we sort of have lost that. I think there's a big map in Disney, and they have pins around the United States where they own TV stations, and we are a little pin down on the Gulf Coast.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with Hearst. They own the San Antonio paper, the Beaumont paper, the Midland paper, of all things. And then, papers all and news magazines and stuff all around. And Houston is just a little pin. Maybe we're red for newspapers and green for TV stations. And you got to figure in their priorities, they don't really care about the quality of news. They care about the cash flow.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're just another line on the spreadsheet.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And we've lost to the old days when Chronicle was owned by Jesse Jones and the Post was owned, well, by, first of all, by the Hobbies for decades and then later on by others. And, you know, we competed and got along, of course, but we competed. And, no, it's all pretty cookie cutter. Now, I will say that I think our local TV stations do a good job with what they have, the money they are allowed to spend. Their anchors are good. I like, you know, their sports and weather. And we'll always have weather, but we don't have sports. Yeah. And I'll tell you what, I get here on my computer a lot of good news. There's something called the Lone Star Project, which is very liberal Democrat. But overnight, they read everything that is read. All the San Antonio, Austin, Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston papers, Texas Monthly, CNN. And you can just go down there. Here, I'm just looking at Dallas Morning News, Houston Chronicle, San Antonio Express News, Fort Worth Star-Telegram, Austin, Dallas Observer, Texas Tribune, New York Times, Washington Post. So, you know, you can go down. They kind of cherry pick. Being kind of liberal, they generally pick the editorials and news that makes the Democrats look good and the Republicans look bad. Although they're being handed that on a silver platter these days. Were you going to go down and cover the Republican convention?
Well, that was one of my questions to you, Lynn, was whether or not you'd be attending that were it happening here in Houston this week.
No, first of all, they probably wouldn't let me in. I have more fun with the Trump administration. I mean, they're just a laugh a minute. But his followers have no sense of humor. And my email is pretty roasty because you know, Houston is a conservative town in a conservative state, although we do have Democratic mayors and such. And they're, you know, Trump won in Texas by 9 percentage points, which in politics is a landslide. You know, if you can get 50% plus one vote, you're a winner. And that's what you generally aim at. When you beat Hillary by 9 percentage points, it's a walk in the park. Mm-hmm. So you have to be troubled. You expect feedback. It's always negative, of course. People who agree with you never say a thing. People who hate what you write always hardly get to the keyboard fast enough. And they'll let you know what they have. But it'll be interesting. As I recall, in the last presidential election, Trump lost all the big cities except Fort Worth. I think he won in Fort Worth, Tarrant County. But then, of course, I say he barreled through the rest of the state. Just you know, look at a color map. And it was all red for Trump, mm-hmm. You know, geographically. Now, you'd rather win Harris County than, you know, Kennedy County down in South Texas where there are no people.
Yeah, or Brewster County out west.
Brewster, yeah. What I find interesting is in our doorstep here, Montgomery County, which is basically a white suburb of Houston, the Woodlands and Conroe and all of that. And did you see that the Republican Executive Committee of Montgomery County voted 40-0 to condemn Governor Greg Abbott for closing some of the water parks and places like that that were just spreading, you know, bugs like mad? They condemned him 40-0. Now, I assume they must have taken a show of hands. I'm sure they couldn't talk because of their masks. They probably outlawed masks in Conroe. It's just crazy. So that's where, you know, they're Trump forever. As Trump said, you know, he could shoot somebody in the middle of Fifth Avenue and not lose a vote. And he's right. He could do almost anything, and he's got these people's votes no matter what.
There is that core base that he literally could do most anything and has done most everything. Mm-hmm. And he's still confident.
Well, I am disappointed in our two senators and, well, all the Republicans from Texas who slavishly follow him no matter what. Now, God gave you a brain. You can approve of some of the things, and I would hope for you would disapprove of some of the things. But, Cruz and Cornyn, I don't think ever voted against anything he proposed. I think they got a 100% voting record. Mm-hmm. And, of course, you have Mitt Romney, and he occasionally gets off the reservation, but not often. But the Texas Republicans are just solid behind him.
Texas has had a history. I mean, even our country, it seems that it's following these big personalities. And when you describe how Texas had been built, Houston in particular had been built, it's really around the innovation and the foresight of some big personalities. Do you see us producing any of those personalities that are larger than life that could really hold a candle to these types of
things? Well, in the last generation, the closest we came was Beto O'Rourke. Mm-hmm. He had some charisma there and had a lot, but he lost. You know, in the final count, he lost. It sort of disappeared. He's still around. No, I think that back in the old days, you are too young to remember. I barely can remember, but Sam Houston, I'm saying this is not that far back. Sam Rayburn ran the House and Lyndon Johnson ran the Senate. And so when there was a space agency to be set up, it came to Texas. When they needed dams in the hill country, they got dams in the hill country. And on, it's just between Rayburn and Johnson. And they were Democrats. And they are rolling over in their ballot box to see what happened to their Texas Democratic Party. It just sort of dissolved. You know, O'Rourke ran against Cruz, but who ran against Cornyn last time? I don't remember, and I don't think anybody else does. Mm-mm. I think he got every vote. I mean, the Democratic Party, remember, it was Will Rogers' famous and often quoted statement, I'm not a member of any political party, I'm a Democrat. Mm. Well, that certainly holds to Texas. So in answer to your question, no, I don't see any right. Well, there are a couple. The congressman out here, congresswoman out here in what was solidly Republican area that was, you know, built, well, it actually went back to George Bush Sr. This was his congressional district, the 6th. And then, of course, Bill Archer had it for, what, 20, 30 years, and mm-hmm. Culberson for another 20 or 30 years, and then it flipped Democrat. Mm-hmm. And we'll have to see in November if it stays Democrat. But that Lizzie is coming on, and... the Democrats have a few rising stars, but, I'll tell you what, what's her name, who got worldwide fame for debating in pink tennis shoes. Wendy Davis. Well, she's kind of carpetbagging. She was from Fort Worth and then moved down to a district in Central Texas. They don't usually like people who move in and say, I'm your leader, but... She's had, you know, a good PR, good staff, obviously gets a lot of free publicity. But I don't know, can you think of any rising Democrats around Texas?
No.
That tells us something right there.
No, but I was hoping I was missing them. I mean, because they seem so essential for people who really, we really do galvanize around leadership.
The Castro brothers.
Yeah, they keep stepping in for each other because they're identical twins and nobody knows who's there. I can't make it. Can you be over there at that rally tomorrow? Oh, yeah. We have the same speechwriters.
Be sure to wear the blue tie. Yeah.
I'll tell you a really interesting thing that we are seeing on TV. It is a blistering ad against Roy, the fellow from the state senator from Dallas.
Royce West.
Yeah, West, Roy West, yeah. He's very well known up in the Metroplex, but not unknown down here. And he's running against this woman on a motorcycle, JJ.
MJ Hagar.
MJ, yeah. But I am seeing commercials against West, how liberal he is and how unfit he would be for Senate. At the very end, I'm John Cornyn, and I approve this message. Now, he's the Republican incumbent, but he's taking out money, TV ads, against a primary opponent. Obviously, his polls show that West is going to win. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that any other polls, but I don't think I've ever seen this before where a Republican is taking out TV ads and spending money to defeat a Democrat in the primary. Mm-hmm. We don't know. He doesn't know who he's going to run against. But he obviously thinks it's West because he's not saying anything about the lady on the motorcycle. So I saw this ad, and I thought, oh, boy, she's getting down and dirty. Boy, that West is a liberal and a bomb thrower, and, you know, he's a friend of Nancy Pelosi's and all that. And then at the end, here's a picture of John Cornyn, who spent money and approved his ad. There's a story there that I don't understand, but all I can figure is he thinks West is going to be his opponent. Mm. So he's starting out early.
Must be more afraid of West than the other. Yeah.
Well, he got the endorsement of the Chronicle and several other around the state. So we just don't know much about him outside of the Metroplex. He's been state senator for a long time up there.
Well, you know, here it is. We're actually visiting with you, Lynn Ashby, and the primary has not finished yet. That's tomorrow as we're speaking here live on tape. We don't know who's going to end up winning that little tussle between MJ and Royce to take on Cornyn. Do you think either of them really, honestly, has more than a snowball's chance, perhaps now because of the shifting tide of the wind?
Well, what usually happens in such cases when it looks like it might be close is everybody takes these secret polls, and if they're ahead, they release them. If they're behind, they keep it secret. And so whoever gets the nomination, the Democrats from all over, are going to be seeing, does he or she have a chance against Cornyn? If they smell victory like with Beto, the money comes in. Everybody loves a winner. If the polls show that it's going to be 60-40 Cornyn, forget it. Put your money in Utah or someplace else. what is it? Money is the mother's milk of politics. Well, so often in the last several years, Democrats have had no candidate and no money, and they just got swamped. And the Democrats in Texas generally ended up giving their money to some other candidate who had a chance of winning. Not in Texas. But I don't know. I just keep reading. CNN says here, I'm just reading, Texas is a swing state in 2020, new polls reveal. So maybe Democrats in the other 49 states start smelling a victory in Texas and will start putting money in there. That's new poll shows Texas is a swing state. You haven't read that in about 40 years.
Yeah. No, not since 94 for sure.
Yeah. And well, I will say that Republicans are organized and have money in Texas, as they do in many other states, and the Democrats don't have either. They just, you know, they keep shooting themselves in the foot with weak candidates, things that don't fly in Texas. It may fly in California, but don't take away my guns, sort of thing. You know, you just can't do that here.
So, Lynn, as we're taping this in advance, we don't know whether or not this woman down Sugar Land Way who and spent $6 or $8 million of her own money and has spent over $8 million of her own money again trying to get a job that pays $174,000 a year. She's got around $16 million that she's invested in so far, at least one, possibly by the time we hear this, two losing causes. Some of those ads that Kathleen Wall versus Troy Neals, that's like watching a soap opera expose itself on the screen, just watching these ads that are coming from her particularly. And well, both of them seem to be coddling up to the Trump voter out in the Southwest quadrant.
Yeah. That whoever wins the primary may have a bit of a problem in November. That area is changing rapidly. They have, oddly enough, a lot of Asians and Sugar Land, Richmond, those are prosperous areas. They're all neurosurgeons out there, you know. And the demographics have certainly changed in that area. And a Democrat may have a chance. Olson, who's retiring, only won his last seat narrowly. He may have looked at the results and said, it's time to retire.
Time to get out of the way, yeah.
Well, now this Wall woman, you know, she ran against Ted Pozo's district up around the Woodlands. And Crenshaw won.
Yep.
Yeah, the sealed with the one eye patch, you know?
Yep.
He won, and that's a really solid Republican area. And so she moved down to that area, and I'll tell you, who tried it was, you know, Bush, one of the Bush children. He did the same thing. He and his wife moved to Sugar Land and announced he was their leader and didn't even make the primary runoff.
Yeah.
Like you said earlier about the carpetbagger model, And that doesn't play with a lot of Texans who profess to uphold family values.
Yeah,
we're tuned to the Open Journal program here on the Mighty 90 KPFT in Houston, having a a meandering and wide-ranging conversation with our friend and columnist Lynn Ashby. We thank you for tuning in on this special edition of Open Journal. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. It has been just wonderful talking to you. You have such a wide range of experiences as we look at this upcoming election and the season and the politics behind politics on a national level. What are your thoughts on Biden and who he picks and how he picks and how the public might receive and the Democratic Party's challenge with picking a real candidate, not who the polls and the surveys say?
Well, poor old Joe, he got himself into a corner when he flat said on TV, "I will pick a woman."
Yeah.
You never say that. You say there are a lot of excellent women candidates out there, and we're certainly examining the list very carefully, that kind of thing. You don't say that. And now he's under pressure to pick an African-American woman. And again, there are several. I like Rice, Condoleezza Rice. I see her on TV. You know, she's a classical pianist, among other things.
Yeah, she is.
And there was talk of her when there was an opening of her being commissioner of NFL. And she either wasn't offered it or didn't take it. But that would have been an interesting choice.
Yeah.
But, you know, the polls are putting Trump behind now. People keep pointing out that all the polls showed that Hillary Clinton was leading Donald Trump in the polls. More people said they would vote for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump. And everybody knocks the pollsters for being wrong. No, they were absolutely right. More people did vote for Hillary Clinton, like 2.3 million more voted for Hillary than for Donald Trump. The polls had it. They just didn't have the Electoral College right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But, of course, it's here again about polls. Again, they're all showing Joe Biden. Now, see, I don't know what you all about. I did not see one single poll in the last presidential election that showed Trump leading. I just didn't see anybody. They came from right, left, and center, mm-hmm. and they all showed Hillary ahead. Mm-hmm. And, President Clinton didn't make it. I'll tell you an interesting political point we're looking at right now. It's a good thing that Greg Abbott is not on the ballot in November. He dodged a bullet.
Good for him, not for us.
Well, and then Dan Patrick, this is an interesting thing. Patrick and Abbott pushed for the convention, Republican state convention for Texas, to be held in Houston, but they weren't going to come. They were going to talk to them by Zoom or teleprompter or something, by TV. They were not going to come, but they were pushing everybody else to come. Now, it's either hypocrisy or, I don't know, they won, but I think Abbott might have a problem with the voters.
Mm-hmm.
Depends on the voters' memory, you know. Depends
on. Yeah, that's 2 years.
Yeah, when it comes around again, Lord knows what could happen between now and then, Lynn.
Yeah, absolutely. The voters, you know, seem to have attention span of a fruit fly, and they just, you know, forget all the, well, 2 years ago election is distant past. So much has happened since then. Mm-hmm. And I tell you, another interesting thing is if we ever get the 2020 census done, and it's an accurate census, Texas is going to get 2 or even 3 more House seats. Mm-hmm. And, that gives us, what, 36 Electoral College votes or something like that, only second to California. And they're going to have to redraw all these boundaries.
Yeah, and who's going to do that?
Well, the Republican-held legislature, unless this upcoming election changes things. We are so gerrymandered. I mean, we have a congressional district that goes from Houston to Austin.
Wow.
It's just crazy. Yeah. There, Travis County, Austin, is in 5 different congressional districts. Now, that's crazy. 2 of them run down to Mexico.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just look at the map. It's crazy.
That is very crazy.
Well, that's one of the big issues in this election that people are really not completely aware of, is that impact with the census and the reapportionment and drawing new lines for all of the congressional districts that will come out of this every 10-year process that we've been doing since 1790.
Yeah, yeah. And because of, the Texas Republicans in the legislature and governor doing everything they can to keep the lines as they are, or at least reflect the Republican legislators for that very reason. It's very important. Sometimes it's not very important, but this is very important. And if this census, what they really want to try to do is delay it. And so the next legislative session we can go with the 2010 maps, and which would mean, of course, a heavy Republican presence in the state legislature, which would, draw up the maps. So there's a lot going on here that more serious than ever. I hate it when people like Sean Hannity say, this is the most important election of our lifetime or in history or something like that. And I say, that is self-important twaddle. It is not the most important. By far, the most important election was 1860. It started a war, the bloodiest war in our history. The outcome of that election, of Abraham Lincoln winning, led to the Civil War. This is so self-important. It is important. But let's not puff up ourselves too much there.
Mm. How do you keep up with all of these narratives and filter through what's the story and what's the smoke and what's the mirror?
Well, let's see. I was a journalist in 1962. Mm-hmm. And ever since then, I go way back. My first scoop, I ran into the city room and yelled, "Stop the chisels." So I go way back. But I it's more interesting. Back when I started covering the state legislature, it was mostly white, male, rural. And they ran the legislature and handed out the money. There were wonderful highways between like Sonora and Ozona, but not between Dallas and Houston. Mm-hmm. It's changed. There are certainly more minorities and women in there now, and they're better educated and more honest. I mean, we had some real scandals back in the old days. They were just crooks. Mm-hmm. The demographics of Texas have just changed, probably more than any other state. People are leaving California and moving to Texas now, turns a 160-year-old route. Texas is now getting 1,000 people a day. Wow. About half of them are births, and half of them are people moving in. They come in from South America and Mexico by the thousands, and then moving in from other states. And they bring with them their political thoughts, the way they voted back in Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And we're having trouble keeping up with it. We can't build enough schools fast enough. You look at the Katy School District. They just can't build high schools fast enough. Mm-hmm. It used to be Katy High School. That was it. That's all they needed was one high school. Mm-hmm. Now they have their own football district, I think, out there. They got so many. Sugar Land, Montgomery County, they just bursting. 1,000 people a day.
But is that because of their opportunity or because Houston is failing in those areas that the buildings and the schools that we have are being emptied because we're not able to provide that type of care or education?
Well, the public schools are being exploding with new students. Of course, a lot of people are now these days sending their kids to private schools, but so they just can't build these schools fast enough. Money, in a word, if you ask why most of them came here, money. Mm-hmm. Jobs, which translates into money. A few decades ago, remember the Rust Belt? It used to be that Cleveland and those areas were booming.
Pittsburgh,
Buffalo, Rochester. Here again, reflecting back to the census, they're all going to lose. New York may lose at least one. Some of the others, and I'll tell you, one of those little blips on the screen, Louisiana, because of Katrina. About 250,000 Katrinians left Louisiana. About 40,000 of them stayed in Houston, in the Houston area. We got a lot of good chefs and halfbacks from them. And we still have, they didn't want to go back. Would you want to send your kid to a Louisiana school? Of course not. So you have these kind of artificial influxes.
Yeah.
And they came from everywhere. I was doing a story on the Russians in the Houston area. One Russian told me there were 25,000 Russians in the Houston area. Wow. Oil, NASA, just different things.
Mm-hmm.
And you name a I keep going back to the census, but I would love to see a breakdown. You know, the Rice professor, Steve Kleinberg.
Yeah.
Just had him on a few weeks ago, Lynn. He was.
Oh, he's great. I remember when it was him and two graduate students with a clipboard going house to house asking. Now he has the Kinder fortune behind him.
Yeah.
And he's great. He's really great. It's the interesting thing about him. He started so long ago that other cities and places are trying to do the same thing, but they don't have 40 years of records. You can't buy that. Mm-hmm. I mean, he can compare automobile purchases today with, you know, 1965 or something like that. And the other people coming in here trying to copy him, and they can start today, but they do not have the background, and you can't get the background that he has. He termed the term he coined it, America's most diversified city. Mm-hmm. And that has been picked up by everybody in and out of Houston. And I think he's right. I mean, you know where to look? Go online and look at Houston restaurants. You start with Afghanistan and go to Zimbabwe.
Yeah. It's really amazing to see the diversity in Houston. And then you compare it to 40 years ago. Yes. And Dwayne has.
I just happen to have a copy of his book. After doing this report, the Houston survey, for 39 consecutive years, just now published a book that he's been working on for about 37 of those years. And it's called Prophetic City, Houston on the Cusp of a Changing America. And he's basically, we've had him on every year for many years now, and he reiterates this every time, that Houston in 2020, Houston represents what America as a whole will look like in 2050, presuming, of course, that there is an America in 2050.
Yeah. He first came to us at the Post with his findings, and they were good. We ran them every year, but they were, you know, just 1/100th of the material he has today. You know, he's got staff and offices and a bankroll from Rice, and people go to him, not just Houstonians, but people like Amazon or somebody who's considering moving here or opening up a bookstore here or whatever it is they want to do. They go to Kleinberg's study, and that tells them all they really need to know about their potential customers here. He's good. I'm sure he'll be looking at this 2020 census too, but this is diversified in a good way. I don't see any race riots around here. We don't have rocks through, well, not many. We don't have ethnic diversity. We have like Chinatown, you know, of course, which has moved. Remember the old days, it was down sort of around the George R. Center.
Yeah.
And now they moved out here on Bel Air. Mm-hmm. And, somebody told me that Houston has two daily newspapers. One is the Chronicle, and the other is Chinese.
Oh, yeah.
That's true.
I haven't been able to track that down.
Well, but, Lynn Ashby, I have a question. You know, I pick up your column every week when it lands in my front yard on Friday morning. Leader over here in the Oak Forest, Garden Oaks Heights region of New York.
Yeah, that's a good paper. It serves that neighborhood very well, I think.
It does, and they toss about 34,000 of those. I read one of them. Mm-hmm. And you've had some recent columns about statues, about school names and songs. And I was wondering, how many of these statues or school names or fight songs, how many of them should go and where should they go?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to go there because you can't please anybody when you take a stand there. Actually, you probably never met another Ashby because there's so few of us, because we were Virginians and got killed by the Yankees. One was shot, the other was bayoneted. So I can't claim they didn't have any children. So there's not very many of us. But, you know, I grew up in Texas, which was, you could argue, was it South or West or what? Mm-hmm. But around the statues, and I'm from Dallas at Lee Park. Golly, that statue of Robert E. Lee was huge, absolutely huge. And he had two Confederates, one on each side, I believe. And, you know, the whole thing was on this pedestal. Yeah, you know, it dominated. It was in Lee Park, of course. And I think they moved it. I don't know where they're going to put it. And, you know, you really start in that column, you know, practically every county in Texas, somewhere in that courthouse yard is a statue to the Confederate soldier. So this is, I quoted Rice Professor Brinkley, what's his name, Stephen Brinkley?
Douglas Brinkley.
Douglas Brinkley, yeah. He said they must have their 21st century moment. In other words, we're judging everybody by today. Mm-hmm. And I keep thinking, what are our great-grandchildren going to think about us? You know, you drove a car, one of those stinky polluting things? Well, yeah, I guess I did. I'm sorry. But you stunk up the planet. Look at this place. You know, so we get pretty high and mighty about our ancestors and what they should have done. And you have to wonder, what should we have done? If, you know, you're going to play that game, be careful. You know, don't. We are probably susceptible to the very same, I won't say revision. It's not revision. It's not changing history. It's trying to tell all sides, is what they say, because they just had, you know, statues to Confederates. Mm-hmm. And very little notice of what they were fighting for, which in Texas' case, we were sort of different. There were not many slave owners in Texas, but they ran the government. They were rich white guys. Nothing's changed. And so you see who were the delegates to our secession conventions and all of that, you know, they came around, mostly came from around the Houston area. Actually, this was the only part of Texas in 1860 that was inhabited, you know, safe. You're getting scalped if you got to as far as Austin or Waco. Mm-hmm. And so they called the shots, and they were mostly slave owners. Most Texans, in fact, a few Texans actually owned slaves. And if you look at the log books of the sign-ins of the young privates who marched off to war, they were mostly poor boys, poor white boys. You know, daddy had and mom had, you know, 14 kids to help with the crops. And they said, you three got to go join the army. I'll be back here. And we had a problem. And we have, again, so many people from elsewhere who really don't know or accept or appreciate or don't appreciate our heritage and history. They don't really know and don't care that Texas was the only state on either side that was fighting a three-front war. We were fighting the Yankees, who conquered Galveston and tried to conquer Sabine Pass and the rest of Texas. We had the entire U.S. Army withdrew from the frontier of Texas, which was very bloody, and all the young men joined the Confederate Army, so all they left, and the Indians moved in right across the border. I mean, from Red River to Mexico. The forts were empty. There was nothing to stop them. And we had Mexican bandits coming up from the valley who were up until the 1920s and stuff, when the Texas Rangers got in so much trouble today. So we had a three-front war going on. And nobody else did. Percentage-wise, some studies show that we sent the most troops into the Confederate Army of any state, percentage-wise of our population. There weren't many of us. Mm-hmm. And so taking all of that into consideration, it puts a different slant on why these people put up the statues. Now, today I can certainly see that you can make an argument to take them down. Now, I don't like them toppling these things. Some of them are really works of art. Sort of like the Vandals or the Goths, you know, just destroy for the sake of destroying. Mm-hmm. But yeah, maybe they don't go in the courthouse yard. But then I would move up to a museum. If that's the case.
As we look at, you know, when you talk about you're an amazing historian and we talk about this robust history, even if we didn't move them at all, the idea that there are other parts of the history that can be added to the story, like
absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, Richmond, Virginia has Monument Row, which is this beautiful boulevard full of statues of Confederates. And the big one at the end is of Robert E. Lee. And I saw a black historian from Richmond University being interviewed, standing there by the statue. And he said, leave it. It's part of our history. But then you need to put a plaque over here, where, like where I'm standing, about all the slaves and the, you know, how they bought and sold children. And he was for leaving the statue there, but just, you know, drop the other shoe.
Yeah. And there are some people who historically were there who were not, you know, all slaves and who were warriors and soldiers and buffalo soldiers. And I mean, there's some amazing parts of American history that have been forgotten. I don't see great statues to the Tuskegee Airmen or great statues to so many nationalities that have done phenomenon is a part of the story that could be a part of the conversation. I think conversation and the conversation we've had with you has been just so wonderful and so needed in our time. And, you know, and as our listeners and as we begin to look at our time, which is never going to be enough with you because you're so phenomenal.
Oh, my goodness. tell our publishers that.
I will. Well, are there any ways you can connect with our listeners so that they can write those positive letters to your publisher? How can they connect with you?
Oh, well, just look at they always say there's the Leader of the Heights, the Park City's News in Dallas. There's the Facts down in Clute, you know.
Brazosport.
Brazosport, yeah, around. not as many as there used to be. You know, newspapers are cutting back. I'm just doing a column now on the death of the smaller papers. They're just... Mm-hmm. If, Facebook didn't kill them, the coronavirus did.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, Lynn Ashby, sorry to say, we've burned through a whole hour here in this conversation, and it's easily we could continue for another. And let's do this again in a sooner than later fashion this time. So,
well, maybe we'll know who won the elections and we can get very wise. Sound like we knew what we were talking about.
Sounds great. Lynn, thank you so much for sharing yourself with PFT and with our listeners here on Open Journal.
Well, it was a lot of fun.
Always.
Take care. All right. Stay healthy.
As well.
Okay.
All right. It is time to wrap this edition of Open Journal. I'm Dwayne Bradley. Our program's available at archive.kpft.org. And you can always subscribe to the podcast, KPFTOJ.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. We are a dedicated all-volunteer production staff. And thank you for your listening and supporting Open Journal. And we are gathered here with engineer Rambling Rick Campbell, producer Susan Phillips, and social media support from Maverick. Open Journal theme music provided by Kevin McLeod. And be here with us for Open Journal next time when we'll have more great conversations. As always, thank you for your support.
And as always, we like to leave you with a thought to carry you through the week. This comes to us from Plato, who said, "Courage is knowing what not to fear." Take care of each other.